140 years ago this week, as the Civil War was entering its third summer, more than 90,000 soldiers from the Army of the Potomac and approximately 75,000 troops from the Army of Northern Virginia fought for 3 days at a crossroads in Pennsylvania's fruit-growing hill country. The clash between Union and Confederate forces in the market town of Gettysburg stands as the largest land battle ever fought in the Western Hemisphere. James McPherson is a professor of history at Princeton University and the author of Battle Cry of Freedom, the Pulitzer Prize-winning history of the Civil War. His latest book is Hallowed Ground, A Walk at Gettysburg. He met us outside of town to the northwest, just off the Chambersburg Pike, to walk us through the first day of the Battle of Gettysburg. Professor McPherson, describe where we are right now.
We're at the east side of what's now called Reynolds Woods. It was called at the time of the battle Herbst Woods, sometimes McPherson's Woods. It's next to the farm owned by Edward McPherson, no relation to me, where the fighting took place on the morning of July 1st, 1863.
Confederate forces led by General Robert E. Lee had marched north from Virginia in mid-June. After humiliating the Union Army at Chancellorsville, northeast of Richmond, the Confederate capital.
Lee decided to use that success as a springboard to invade the North with the hope that one more victory would so demoralize the Army of the Potomac and the Northern people and so discredit the Lincoln administration's war policy that Lee might actually be able to conquer a peace on Northern soil.
General Lee allowed his flamboyant cavalry commander, Major General Jeb Stuart, to break off from the Army of Northern Virginia.
His orders were to maintain contact with the infantry, with the main body of the Army of Northern Virginia, and to send information to Lee about the whereabouts and marching direction and so on of the Union Army of the Potomac, which was following on the inside track, staying between the invading Confederate infantry and Washington, D.C.
The Union Army moved north from Washington to counter the Confederates, ultimately cutting Stuart off from Lee as Union troops moved into Pennsylvania.
Because Stuart did get behind the Union Army, that meant that that whole army was between him and Lee's Army of Northern Virginia for more than a week. And Stuart did not maintain contact.
Having lost his cavalry eyes, General Lee had little intelligence on the position and strength of Union forces. Moving ahead of the infantry, the Union cavalry arrived in Gettysburg on the last day of June. They were under the command of Brigadier General John Buford.
He saw signs that the Confederates were probably up the Chambersburg Pike west of Gettysburg. And in fact, one infantry brigade marched close enough to Gettysburg that afternoon so that Buford actually saw them, or his vedettes, as they were called in cavalry, out on the road, spotted them. And Buford looked around and said, this might be a good place to fight if we have to fight, and I think Lee's coming this way with most of his army.
Lee was on the way, paradoxically, from the north. A division of Confederates, led by Major General Henry Heath, who was under strict orders from General Lee not to bring on a full-scale battle, came upon an outlying picket of the Union cavalry.
Lieutenant Marcellus Jones of the 8th Illinois Cavalry was out there with a small picket post and fired the first shot about 7:30 in the morning against that advancing Confederate infantry.
In the early morning light of July 1st, Heath at first believed he'd encountered a local militia. Instead, he'd chanced upon Buford's battle-hardened Union horsemen. The Union troops fell back from ridgeline to ridgeline toward the town, fighting all the way. Having anticipated trouble, Buford had requested reinforcements the day before from Major General John Reynolds, commander of the Union Army's First Corps. With the Confederates advancing, Buford now anxiously stood watch in the cupola of Gettysburg's Lutheran Theological Seminary.
As the morning wore on and the Confederates built up more and more force and his cavalry was becoming significantly outnumbered, he grew quite worried. And then around 10 o'clock in the morning, maybe a few minutes before 10 o'clock in the morning, he looked south, and there he saw Reynolds and his staff galloping across the fields, followed by Union infantry of the 1st Brigade of the 1st Division of the 1st Corps, the Iron Brigade, right behind them. And it was when Reynolds was putting the Iron Brigade, probably the best fighting unit in the Army of the Potomac, three Wisconsin, one Indiana, one Michigan regiment, they fought right where we're standing. As Reynolds was putting them into action, that's when he got shot.
Reynolds fell from his horse, dead from a bullet in the head. Major General Abner Doubleday, the same Doubleday mythically credited with inventing baseball, took over command of the 1st Corps. The battle continued in a close-range firefight. One of the men on the Union side that morning was a 72-year-old shoemaker and Gettysburg resident named John Burns. Incensed by the Confederate invasion, he picked up a rifle from a fallen soldier and joined the fight.
He was wounded three times, left wounded on the battlefield, and when the Confederates discovered him, they were quite surprised, and they said, "We can't capture this old man," so they turned him over to Union medics. He recovered from his wounds, so they turned out not to be too severe, and he lived another 8 or 9 years. And when he died in the early 1870s, eventually the local residents here in Gettysburg put up a statue to him. It's the only statue on the battlefield to a civilian. And probably, as far as I know at any rate, the only statue or monument anywhere on Civil War battlefields to a 72-year-old man.
Across the Chambersburg Pike, an overpass on a Park Service road crosses a set of railroad tracks. In 1863, the tracks had not yet been laid, but the railroad bed had been cut. Confederate forces from Mississippi and North Carolina crawled through the railroad cut to ambush Union troops. A Wisconsin regiment from the Iron Brigade rushed in.
They counterattacked against the Confederates, 200 or 300 of whom were in this cut. And suddenly the cut turned from a kind of ready-made trench to infiltrate through Union lines into a trap.
Scores of Confederates were captured, many were killed. Elements of the Union Army's 11th Corps arrived on the battlefield early that afternoon to support the 1st Corps, which had been engaged in combat since mid-morning. There was heavy fighting on these open fields north of town. It was something of a stalemate, until a Confederate division, led by Major General Jubal Early, attacked the 11th Corps' right flank, causing the Union position to crumble. As the Union line folded, soldiers fled south through Gettysburg's town square. What would a citizen of the town, who hadn't already left town, have seen that afternoon as Confederate troops were chasing the Union troops through here?
If they were really wise, they wouldn't have seen anything because they would have been hiding in their cellars. And indeed, many of them did hide in their cellars. But some of the younger ones, younger people always do, refused to obey their parents and stayed up to try to watch what was going on. Fortunately, none of them was hurt.
Had those young people peeked through a window, they would have seen the chaos of Union soldiers streaming through town.
By the time most of them got here, they were pretty disorganized and were intent only on escaping to Cemetery Hill, where their officers told them they would find support. So it would have been close to a rout, but both sides would still have been taking casualties in what really amounted to at least a short interim of urban street fighting.
The Union soldiers fled south, away from the center of town. Many reached the western slope of Culp's Hill. Others found themselves on nearby Cemetery Hill, the highest ground in the immediate area. The Confederates, under Lieutenant General Richard Ewell, followed. At the end of the first day, General Lee ordered Lieutenant General Ewell to attack the Union forces on Cemetery Hill, if practicable. Those were his words. And Ewell decided it was not practicable. What were the consequences of that decision?
One important consequence was that the Army of the Potomac was given time to consolidate itself, recover from its retreat and defeat, dig in, establish a defensive position not only on Cemetery Hill, but overnight over here on Culp's Hill as well. And ever since that time, many historians, especially Confederate or Southern historians, have criticized Ewell for not attacking, on the assumption that if he had attacked quickly, if he had continued the momentum of the success in late afternoon of July 1st, that they would have been able to push the Union forces off the high ground at Cemetery Hill and take control of that high ground themselves, and that the battle would have come out much differently as a consequence.
James McPherson thinks it's unlikely that General Ewell could have overrun the Union forces on Cemetery Hill. He would have met artillery and a fresh brigade from the 11th Corps, and more reinforcements from the Union Army of the Potomac were on the way.
Even if Ewell had managed, and it was now getting on toward dusk, to drive Union forces off of Cemetery Hill, a counterattack by two or three of those fresh Union divisions might well have driven him back in turn, because his forces were tired.
Blame, instead, rests with General Lee.
I think the consensus of many historians now is that if there was a fault in the Confederate failure to attack on late afternoon, early evening against Cemetery Hill on July 1st, Lee bears principal responsibility for that. He was there, he was on the ground. If he wanted an attack, he should have ordered it.
At the end of the first day, casualties on the Union side numbered 9,000. There were 8,000 Confederate casualties. The Battle of Gettysburg would go on another 2 days, ending with the bloody slaughter of Pickett's charge, where 7,500 Confederate soldiers were killed, wounded, or captured. General Robert E. Lee, his invasion of the North a disaster, took his broken army back south across the Potomac River to his home state, Virginia. General George G. Meade, the overall commander of Union forces at Gettysburg, failed to pursue Lee to deal a death blow to the Confederate Army. It would never again strike on Northern soil, but it fought on for almost 2 more years. Standing on Culp's Hill with a gentle breeze blowing through the tall grass, James McPherson reflects on the legacy of the first 3 days of July 1863. He says every time he visits Gettysburg, he's struck by how America would be such a different nation today, possibly more than one nation, had the battle gone another way.
That kind of awareness of how the present might be radically different had it not been for what took place on the very ground where we're standing is what makes it important to me and what makes it come alive. These ghosts of events that happened 140 years ago are still present in our imagination, and if our imagination is vivid enough, they're palpably present here as we stand.
James McPherson is a professor of history at Princeton University. He is also the author of Hallowed Ground, A Walk at Gettysburg, published by Crown. Professor McPherson, thank you so much for taking us on a tour of Gettysburg.
Well, I enjoyed it very much.
To learn more about Gettysburg and to see photographs of the battlefield and some of the battle's central figures, please visit our website at npr.org.